Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guests tonight are Roberta J.M. Olson, curator of drawing at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and J.M. Pasikoff, field memorial professor of astronomy and director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. And we're continuing our conversation about the beautiful, fascinating book they wrote together, Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. Welcome, both of you, Roberta and Jay. It's a real pleasure to talk to you. It's funny, rereading this book, this go-round for the questions. This is such a brilliant book. I really want to make sure people know about this book because I just think it's such a special book. How did this book...
We agree.
Yeah, I mean, you don't read a lot of books like this that have a great knowledge of astronomy matched with a great knowledge of art, and it becomes
and,
a sort of...
And also literature, we hope.
Literature.
And also history. I mean, that was the real challenge in writing this, to incorporate all of it, and it was magical because it does intersect. I mean, it was like channeling yourself back into the time, but then also having the historical perspective and backing away so you could be able to do it. And it's rare when you find, I think, this kind of intersection and dovetailing of all the sciences and all the arts and humanities. And that's what we aim for, because there's a lot of physics in it, too.
There's a lot. There's hard. I mean, this is a hard science book as well as a hard cultural book too.
With a light touch, and I think we also wanted it accessible. So
it's entertaining.
The levels, we tried to aim for the levels, although we wanted to make it accessible to everyone, so you could enter it on whatever level you were and get something out of it, and especially visually.
Yeah, absolutely. Jay, let's start talking about comets, and then we'll go back to the moon.
Sure.
I'm fascinated by all the chapters in this book, all the different astronomical phenomena. It seems like things change when people get developed the telescope and then the photograph.
Well, one of the people who got interested earlier than that was Edmund Halley.
Yep.
And he started working with Newton just before 1787, when Newton's book came out. They had a coffee house in London, which wound up as what we today still call the Royal Society, and they heard that this young guy up in Cambridge, which I go in an hour on the train, but it used to be a day's journey and by stagecoach, they heard this young guy named Isaac Newton had solved a problem about orbits, and Halley went up to see him and asked why the orbits were if the gravity fell off with the square of the distance, what would the orbits be, and Newton said, why, an ellipse, and that excited Halley. And without going into detail now, Halley extracted from Newton within a couple of years Newton's great book, the so-called the Principia, the Mathematical
Yep.
Principles of Natural Philosophy. And in fact, all the money of the Royal Society had been used up on some other book, and Halley wound up paying for the publication of Newton's book. So anyway, that was 1687. Now in 1715, Halley realized it was going to be an eclipse across England. Now, what was the year of the comet? I think it might have been. Let's see. I know.
1680 was the comet that is in the foldout. 1680 to 81 was the wonderful foldout in the Principia with the parabolic orbit that was drawn. It was fantastic.
Yes, so I know I do have a first edition of the Principia, and near the front is a fold-out page.
Wait a minute, whoa, back up. You have a first edition of the Principia?
Yes. when I have a textbook in astronomy, and when a first edition came out already in the 1970s, I decided to try to buy the books by the people who I mentioned there.
Whoa.
So I do have first editions by Newton and Halley and Galileo, for example. So that's been a lot of fun.
I'm infinitely jealous of you. That's amazing. So
this last semester, I gave a course to a dozen people, a dozen students, along with Wayne Hammond, who is the Chapin librarian at Williams College, where we looked through a number of these books and discussed the books themselves as well as the scientific significance.
Well, let's get back to comets. That just amazed me that you said that.
Yes.
I just wanted to make sure.
Anyway, so when Newton and Halley got interested in comets, and they collected observations of comets that had gone back for hundreds of years, and it turns out they realized that there was a periodicity, that the same comet had come back time and again. They hadn't even realized at that time that the comet seen in the evening in Cambridge, England, or London, and the comet seen in the early morning were the same one. And so the idea that it was the same comet was also a new idea. And they collected the dates of these bright comets returning and realized that it was periodic.
Of all the sections of your book, I have to say the artwork and the historical artwork about comets seem the weirdest. I don't know how to explain it, but there's some really unusual artworks represented in the comets section.
Now, well, Roberta is a professor of art history, so she knows about all kinds of art from all over.
But I mean,
I think that it was what, you know, it has to do with also whatever is celestial, all the elements that appear in the sky. Comets can be the most dramatic, and it goes back to this whole idea of periodicity, that they were always unexpected before Halley
right.
and Newton did this. So every time you saw something in the sky, it was like fear and trembling because it was, you know, I think this was, and something always bad happened. So
it right, it was a sign of God's wrath or approval, depending upon who
exactly,
interpreted.
Or a portent, or the death of a king, or the birth of a king, because it was a kind of double-edged sword. But also remember that before we have this horrible light pollution, these comets were unbelievable, whether they had a tail
yeah.
of 25 degrees, and some of them had tails of 120 degrees across the sky. So if you remove all the light and see the sky as black almost, except for maybe a sprinkling of stars, depending, and you didn't have the moon up, it would be unbelievable. And sometimes they would stay, you know, unlike meteors, they flash across the sky. Comets could hang there. The longest was Hale-Bopp, I think, for nearly 10 months in 1995. But they could stay there for months. And so here, they were called bearded stars. They were called wandering stars because they defy the order of the universe. Eclipses could be predicted, solar and lunar, since the time of the Babylonians, but comets could not be. And that's why, what Jay said, when Halley realized that the comet of 1456 was the same as the comet of 1705, and he wrote his Astronomiae Cometicae Synopsis, and he predicted that that comet would come back, okay? In 1758, he did not live to see it. Everybody else was waiting in 1758 for it to appear again. He died in 1742. But it was amazing because that was the proof of the theory that he hatched with the help of Newton. I mean, it was absolutely unbelievable.
Now, before we talk about the artwork, I want to talk about comets in reality. Where do comets come from?
They come from two places, the Oort cloud, which is way out, and those are the long-period comets, and the short-period comets, which are 200 years or less, come from the Kuiper belt, it is thought. Some comets are called sun grazers, and they might be destroyed by the sun, but they flare up brilliantly. And some have, it's believed, orbits that are so long and so parabolic that they go out and never come back. The comet Leonard, the Christmas comet from this year, and that's another thing, there are so many comets being discovered now because of our technology. The comet Leonard that was discovered as a Christmas comet of 2021, they think has a period of return of 80,000 years.
Oh, Jesus.
Can you imagine that? So unlike Mark Twain, who came in with the Halley's Comet in 1835 and said his only wish, of course, Mark Twain, which master of overstatement, said his only wish was to go out with a comet in the next apparition, which he did in 1910.
But it, what do we
so we had Halley's Comet in 1910, and then around 1986.
And I saw it. Yeah, I remember looking at Halley's Comet then.
Yeah, so the next one will be around 2061, and the one of the physics educational institutions started a project, 2061, that will have all the students in the United States up to date in science by the goal of 2061, Project 2061. It's a good goal.
It's a great goal.
It's a fabulous goal.
I wish it would occur sooner. But as Roberta was talking about, you know, back in the day, say in the 1400s, 1500s, there was not a lot of light pollution from cities, so that when these comets appeared, they have to have been incredibly dramatic. We can't see comets the way people used to see comets because of the light pollution.
Well, that's true for a bunch of comets, but every once in a while there's a really bright comet that you can see. The brightest one that comes to my mind was Hale-Bopp, which was back in
95
is its official number, but it was really brightest. It was discovered in 95, but it was really brightest in 97. And I was at a concert at Carnegie Hall in New York with my wife, Naomi, and I figured in intermission we'd run out and maybe go up to Central Park where it was darker from 57th Street, two blocks further south. But I came out right under the marquee of Carnegie Hall with all the bright lights down.
Oh, no.
And looked left at the edge of 57th Street, looked due west, and there was a comet hanging there. So we just saw the comet with all the lights. And the next night, we had a friend with an apartment on Fifth Avenue looking west, so we went to visit them, and I have a photograph that I reproduce in my textbook of Hale-Bopp over Central Park in the middle of New York City. So it depends how bright the comet is.
And I was in Norton, and I went out every night to look at it because it was just so special, and to be able to be in Norton, which is has less light pollution than New York City, it was an amazing treat. But it was dispassionate. We were admiring, both you and I, the beauty of this celestial show. Whereas in the past, people would have had fear and trembling about this because they didn't know what it portended.
Well, I want to talk about the artwork for a minute of comets.
And then we just make one other comment. First, my colleagues here at our Keck Northeast Astronomy Consortium, the last couple of nights, have been photographing the James Webb Space Telescope.
Oh, nice.
As it's a million miles away, going further and further out. But it's showing up as a dot in the sky. And as a kind of a fun exercise, several of the colleagues are going to look from the different locations around New England and pinpoint it and make long, skinny triangles and measure how far it is away. Just as an exercise.
Can you see that with an unaided eye?
No, it's taking a telescope to do that.
That's what I thought. I want to talk about the Bayeux Tapestry, 1066.
Yes, my wife and I went to Bayeux especially to see that.
And that has a comet on it. Do we know what comet that is?
Yes, it's Halley's Comet.
Wow.
Of 1066. And supposedly, it's actually in this sort of cruel-like tapestry, because it really isn't a tapestry. It's called that, but it's wool on linen, and it's inscribed in Latin, look at the star, and everyone's pointing up. But it looks like a very primitive rocket that
right.
I know my stepbrother made. It's really a weird, it looks mechanical. And, of course, you could interpret it either way, either victory for either side or the death of a king. And people did that. They used this as a symbol. But it's a very interesting comet because it shows a nucleus, actually. And it actually begins to show the center of condensation around it. And then you have a very stylized representation of the tail, but you get the fiery quality of it, as well as the diaphanous, but not as nicely as the diaphanous.
Now, you write that Giotto had the first convincing portrait of a comet in a painting.
Yes, and it is actually Giotto that got me into the whole thing. I was teaching in Wheaton College in Massachusetts, near you, and I always used to spend 80 minutes on early Giotto and presenting the Arena Chapel. And in one of my first years teaching there, I came to the Adoration of the Magi, and I looked into the blue sky, the lapis lazuli blue sky, and I thought, oh my goodness, it was like Eureka. I said, what is this? It's not a star of Bethlehem. And I asked my class, as any good teacher would do, can you tell me why that's a comet? Okay. They all looked at me, and of course, as Jay knows, you have to answer. You have to come up with an answer. So I actually went and researched for 2 months before I gave them the answer and found that there was a chronicle at the time, Giovanni Villani, in 1301, who described a comet that, of course, Halley, his predictions would go back. And it was Halley's comet in 1301 that appeared in Florence, where Giotto would have been, in overall of Italy. And he obviously did this portrait of a comet, because all comets are different. Their profiles
yeah.
are like people's profiles, and they change. They're also dynamic. And then I did some more research, and I found out, well, lo and behold, the church fathers, although the Bible doesn't have it, described the Star of Bethlehem in language that sounded like a comet. Okay, because, you know, it's debated, was there a star?
Right.
Was it a conjunction of planets? Did it happen at all? Was it a literary device? But the
Hello?
Giotto
yeah.
was the first person who married that with an actual apparition. And it's still dazzling. He shows all the anatomical parts of the comet, and it's blazing and diaphanous and pulsing. And you feel that this is really something magical and important and awesome.
You're listening.
So the European Space Agency actually wrote maybe telegram to Roberta.
Telegram
to ask her permission to name their spacecraft after Giotto.
All right.
And can you imagine that? And I didn't save the telegram. Can you believe it?
You did or did not? I didn't hear.
She did.
I did not.
You didn't?
Oh, well,
no.
Well, but I can make the following announcement. That it occurred to me that I know some people who have discovered asteroids, and I looked into naming one after Roberta for her big birthday that's coming up. So we were able to name an asteroid for
Whoa.
Roberta's birthday this year, and it's going to be named Roberta J. M. Olson.
Isn't that wonderful? And I should also add that Jay was given the honor long ago, and his wife Naomi. So we're going to be in the heavens together as asteroids.
Yes.
I love it.
And I asked if they could find a number that was had 1301 or something with Giotto in it. So I think it's going to be 471301, if I remember right. Asteroid Roberta J. M. Olson.
Isn't that fabulous? And what's yours again?
I'm 5100.
Wow.
And Naomi 68109, Naomi Pasikoff.
There we are. And I should say that this really brought Jay and I together, because after publishing this in Scientific American, which I sent it to Scientific American when I wrote up the paper after the 2 months, they sent me a letter back in 2 days, all right, and said, we want to publish it. It was published, and that's after that, the telegram came. And so I decided to do an exhibition at the Smithsonian Institution, also wrote a book, Fire and Ice, A History of Comets and Art, because by that time I had accumulated a lot of material. And when all that happened and Halley's was in the sky, a colleague of Jay's, Samuel Edgerton, in the art department, who was on our visiting committee at Wheaton College, invited me to give a talk. And guess who was there? Jay. Okay. And so after the talk and during the talk, I mean, I kept seeing him nodding. And after the talk, we spoke. And it turns out that we had sort of similar approaches to things. And we went out afterwards with one of his students and his daughter, Deborah, and actually looked at Halley's comet in the sky. And it's interesting because before photography, most astronomers drew. In fact, even Newton drew comets in his astronomical notes. And astronomers are very visual. They have to look at things now, whether it's through the telescope or naked eye. And we found that there was this incredible synergy between our approaches to visual material. And of course, Jay collecting rare books was already in it, and he's interested in art. And I've always been interested in science. I read astronomy books as a child, and I've always been interested in natural history, too. So anyway, it was great.
Well, and we've been working together ever since.
Collaborated.
I still have a bunch of questions asking. We're going to run out of time.
Okay.
One of the weird things about the comet section, too, is there's a bunch of what I would call comics in the style of Thomas Rowlandson that are rather ribald, like Carolyn Herschel smelling at the comet. It's what is it about the comets that made people do cartoons like that?
Because at the time, it was a very popular thing, and that was they flourished as cartoons during the age where comets and meteors were separated. Kladni wrote his treatise in 1744 about meteors that established them as very different from comets. And once you're able to be objective about something, you can poke fun at something.
Right, right.
Okay? And so, and Carolyn Herschel, just to say, she discovered eight comets. And Jay and I have published her actual observations and drawings of those comets through a comet seeker. But once you're objective about something, you can poke fun at it. And this was the period. I mean, now it would be all over, you know, Twitter and Insta and everything else. But these prints were part of the beginning of media. They were circulated and they sort of followed after the 16th and 17th century broadsides. These were actually posted in coffee houses. So you go to get your coffee and talk to your friends, and these things would be circulated. They were topical. And so not only the science part of it, but also the humor, once the sting, if I may say it, on threat had been removed, you could poke fun at it. You could enjoy it. You could have it be light. But there was also a kind of profundity to it. And then there are things like the Rowlandson looking at a comet till you get the crick in the neck.
Right, yeah.
And you have this older man who's obviously the father looking at the comet with his comet seeker, a small telescope. And behind him, you have his daughter with her suitor, and he's about to kiss the inside of her arm. Very, you know, erotic, very naughty. And then you have someone like Napoleon who says, oh, well, the birth of kings, the death of kings, I'm going to be a legitimate ruler. So, hey, I'm going to latch my identity to a comet, which he did. And so, of course, all the English had great fun with that.
Oh, my God.
I mean, they played with it. You know, it was great. But this was social media of the day.
And we're almost out of time, but I want to mention, there's in this book, there's amazing Jackson Pollock, which is... So Jackson Pollock, I wasn't that familiar with, which is amazing in itself. He did a painting called Comet.
Yes, and I had never seen it reproduced before we started work on this. And looking at it, he actually titled it, "And Many Jackson Pollocks Are Not Given."
Right. That's what surprised me.
Although he gave titles more than someone like de Kooning or Franz Kline, other abstract expressionists. But he was notorious for doing drip paintings and expressing his moods. But it's like he's painted a vertical, a very tall vertical.
And that was not typical either.
Yep, you're absolutely right. They're usually horizontal. And then he has this broad slash of white that just goes from corner to corner on a diagonal, as though he's really grasped the essence of the universe. And then you begin to look at all the other white behind it, and he really did get it. It's as though it's infinite. And then you have this slice of the comet, which is like a messenger, because we know that comets are material, isn't that right, Jay, from the leftover from the Big Bang. They're primordial elements. So that's another thrill with comets, because you feel like you're going back to the moment of the Big Bang when you look at this, and it's just riveting.
Now, one last quick note to Jay. Has Earth ever been hit by a comet?
Well, certainly there is some intermediate stuff. There was something near Chelyabinsk in Moscow just 5 years ago.
Oh, that huge thing that came down.
Glanced off. There was the Tunguska, we say, meteorite.
Well, I was going to ask you, was that a meteorite, an asteroid, or was it a comet?
Well, nobody really knows, but probably a little rockier. There is this new TV, not movie, we saw it on streaming, Don't Look Up.
Oh, yeah.
Which is from supposedly from a comet that's going to hit the Earth. And they're trying to make something parallel to global warming in that the powers that be in Washington and the national capitals ignore something that's as plain as day to the to the scientists. I do think there's a big difference in that the global warming is a gradual thing that creeps up on you, like that famous boiling frog who doesn't notice until it's too late. And so that's more like a global warming, whereas a comet, if it's going to hit you at one time and kill everything, that's much more dramatic.
Well, on that, we're going to have to stop, because we're out of time. We're really out of time. My returning guests tonight are Roberta J.M. Olson, curator of drawing at the New York Historical Society and professor emerita of art history at Wheaton College, and Jay M. Pasikoff, field memorial professor of astronomy and director of the Hopkins Observatory at Williams College. We have been talking about one of the most amazing books I have read. It's a beautiful combination of science and art, Cosmos, the Art and Science of the Universe. Roberta and Jay, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for inviting us.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.